From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. After a big win in the Supreme Court, one gay marriage advocate evaluates the messaging tactics used by his side.
In most of our ads, we have no gay people. Our grandparents talk about how proud they are of their gay children, or our coworker, or our neighbor, or someone else besides an actual LGBT person.
And in Washington, lawmakers grapple with secret interpretations of the laws that govern its not-so-secret surveillance programs.
It's like there were two Patriot Acts. My constituents can't read the one that actually matters.
Plus, a woman dies and her family finally opens that locked box she told them never to touch.
They busted it open with a screwdriver, and inside it was a birth certificate in someone else's name.
There's more coming up after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week in Washington, the world's geekiest foot race as reporters, or their interns, sprinted to the cameras with two landmark high court rulings.
Now, Shannon Bream, just out from the U.S. Supreme Court, she's got her gym shoes on, she's running toward our camera, she has the decision now in her hands.
The court struck down a key provision of the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, which blocked federal recognition of gay marriage, and then let stand a California decision that struck down a gay marriage ban there. The rulings came as American acceptance of gay marriage accelerates.
We have now hit a point here in the U.S. where more than half the population, 51%, say that they favor allowing gays and lesbians to marry legally.
That's Amy Mitchell, acting director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism.
That compares to 42% who say they oppose it. And if you look back to 2009, the breaks at that point in time were just 35% that favored it versus 54% that opposed.
Hmm. Do you have any notion of what changed in 2009?
Specifically, a lot of what we heard were things like, I know somebody personally who is gay or lesbian or homosexual in some way. I have a personal connection to somebody.
Did you happen to see the Tonys the year before this one, when Neil Patrick Harris did a big routine about how the gays own Broadway?
I saw clips of it.
If you feel like someone that this world excludes, it's no longer only for dudes who like dudes. Attention, every breeder, you're invited to the theater. It's not just for gays anymore.
Not that Broadway was any kind of a holdout, but, you know, it is a national broadcast designed to get people to go to Broadway, so there must have been a high degree of confidence that this wasn't going to be a turnoff.
One of the questions that was asked was, you know, how would you feel if you had a son or daughter that came to you and said that they were gay or lesbian? And there, too, we see much greater acceptance. I believe it was 55% that said they would not be upset if their son or daughter came to them and said that he or she was gay or lesbian.
So, with victory in the courts and in many state votes on the issue, and those polls, you might assume from the media that the war is over. And in fact, Pew found that most Americans, whether for or against same-sex marriage, believe it is now inevitable. But is it? Crucially, both high court decisions throw the onus for gay marriage back to the states, many of which have strong voter opposition to it, and where the battles between advocates and opponents will likely go on and on. David Dodge is a researcher and gay marriage advocate who has studied the messaging from both sides and doesn't think his side has done all that well.
Well, you don't need to look any further than our track record before this past November. Of the 40 statewide LGBT ballot measures that I looked at in my report, only three went our way. So regardless of the media, regardless of anything else going on, we clearly were having a hard time connecting with voters.
As you observed, there were a handful of strategies that the anti-gay marriage campaigns were using. One was an appeal to traditional marriage.
The most precious gift of all. A man, a woman, a child, a family. The way marriage should always be. Please, Vote yes on Measure 36.
And of all of the media that I looked at for this report, 75% contain this kind of traditional marriage theme. It will show this happy nuclear family. And it could be as simple as two or three words, one man, one woman, for God's design, and that's the ad.
What's the most effective strategy?
This messaging that targeted children, and specifically in the school system, that tried to convince voters that if same-sex marriage were to be legalized, that children in schools would learn about LGBT relationships, and that children will be encouraged to experiment with an LGBT lifestyle. We found it's very, very effective. So there's this ad that is very familiar to most voters in California and to anyone that's worked on any of these LGBT ballot measure campaigns called the Prince's ad.
Mom, guess what I learned in school today?
What, sweetie?
I learned how a prince married a prince, and I can marry a princess.
Think it can happen? It's already happened. When Massachusetts legalized gay marriage, schools began teaching second graders that boys can marry boys. The courts ruled parents had no right to object.
The messaging is not true. There's no correlation between where same-sex marriage has been legalized and whether or not schools teach about gay marriage or about gay relationships as completely independent.
You took this ad door to door?
Right. I worked with this fantastic organization called Vote for Equality that's based in Los Angeles. And since Proposition 8, they've just been trying to figure out, okay, so clearly our strategy up until now has not been working. We've lost every single campaign, basically, that we've tried to win. So since 2008, they have been going door to door in neighborhoods in Los Angeles, trying to find voters who voted in favor of Proposition 8 and to have long, extended conversations with them to try to figure out why. And they would do a little bit of a survey with them. It was over 1,000 surveys. And after that, they would have little video players, and they would show the voter, the Princess ad in particular, and then ask them to rate their position after that. So 15% of all voters were negatively impacted by this ad. 26% of all undecided voters were negatively impacted, and 14% of our supporters were negatively impacted. So these are people that, in theory, would be planning on voting in favor of same-sex marriage and then changing their mind after seeing this one ad.
So strong evidence that this harm to kids argument was a winner. But what you observed is that the anti-gay marriage campaigns began to adopt another strategy.
Yes, since documents that were court-ordered to be released by the National Organization for Marriage in March of 2012, the two major things that came out of it that was that they were using a race-baiting strategy where they were literally trying to go into communities of color and pit them against LGBT communities, and the other was to try to flip a prominent pro-LGBT messaging strategy, one that's actually not that effective in getting people to support same-sex marriage, that says that LGBT people are victims of discrimination and are persecuted against. Anti-LGBT advocates developed a concerted strategy to try to co-opt that messaging and to say that it's actually people that are opposed to same-sex marriage that are persecuted against. They're the ones that are the victims.
Question one means consequences, as has occurred elsewhere, like Vermont.
A lesbian couple sued us for not supporting their gay wedding because of our Christian beliefs. We had to pay $30,000 and can no longer host any weddings at our inn.
Vote no on question one to avoid this in Maine.
But last year was a losing year for anti-gay marriage people.
It was. It was pretty fantastic for us. I don't want to claim that it was just a change in media strategy on both sides that got us to victory, but I do think it played a prominent role. They gambled on this different media fame, and it didn't pay off. It didn't connect with voters in the same way that this kids in school messaging really does. And on the opposite end, pro-LGBT advocates had been doing a much better job at developing ads that were much more emotional and able to connect with voters in a way that was able to win their support.
Okay, so now let's go back to the very bad job that you say the pro-gay marriage people did up until last year.
Sure, yeah.
When you were active in this issue in Florida, you turned on your TV and went, ugh.
I would turn on my TV and watch these ads that were developed from my side, and we would try to trick people into thinking that this has nothing to do with the LGBT community.
What do you mean? How?
There's really no other way to say it. The ads that we ran in Florida really focused on the potential for senior citizens to be impacted by the loss of gay marriage.
What?
Sorry, exactly. Senior citizens in civil unions would lose their benefits.
Had I not had domestic partner, Helene would have had to wait
on the gurney for 4.5 hours before the surgery happened alone. That's not right.
Amendment 2 takes away rights and benefits.
I don't want the state of Florida and Amendment 2 to take away the rights of Wayne and I to be together.
Again, this is a potential, but this is not the point of these amendments. People are not trying to target domestic violence victims. They're not trying to target senior citizens. In Arizona, I think it was in 2006, we didn't skirt the same-sex marriage issue completely there, but we did say that this was going to have an impact on all unmarried couples. And we actually won that campaign by saying that straight people that are in civil unions would be impacted.
And in those ads, you had no gay people?
No. In most of our ads, we have no gay people. 18% of our ads, going back to 1998, prominently feature LGBT couples. Even fewer ever had a speaking role.
You mean you just had happy, smiling faces?
Exactly. That's actually still true this past November. Our grandparents talk about how proud they are of their gay children, or our coworker, or our neighbor, or someone else besides an actual LGBT person. I should say we're at least not afraid of talking about same-sex marriage with people anymore. There's this really interesting research that was done by this organization called Third Way and an LGBT group in Oregon called Basic Rights Oregon. In 2010, they did a survey to try to see what kind of came to mind when they thought of marriage for different groups. When asked why LGBT couples want to get married, 42% responded for rights and benefits. When they were asked why couples like you want to get married, 72% said to publicly acknowledge their love and commitment to one another. So we ourselves have created this dichotomy in people's minds about what marriage is for LGBT people and what marriage is for straight people.
Does this suggest where the next strategy lies for phase two?
Absolutely. And the ads that we saw this past November did a much better job expressing these sorts of emotional reasons why LGBT people want to get married.
Gay grandma is what one of our producers
gay grandma
is suggesting.
That's a fantastic idea. We should find a gay grandma.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Media researcher and gay rights advocate David Dodge. After the High Court ruling on same-sex marriage, the conservative media watchdog site Newsbusters compiled a montage of what it saw as CNN's pro-gay marriage bias.
History-making in the look at that. That is jubilation, folks.
Pretty extraordinary moment here, quite frankly, Ashley.
We now know what the first line of Anthony Kennedy's obituary, many years in the future, will be. He is the justice who is the author of the three most important gay rights decisions in the history of the Supreme Court.
Newsbusters has this right. The mainstream media does seem to be acknowledging what the court seems to be acknowledging, and a majority of the public seems to be acknowledging, that it's somehow unseemly to deny some people the right to marry. True, the court chose to punt the issue to the states, many of which are disinclined to extend that right, but there is momentum, and you could hear it on CNN. The media tend not to rush ahead of the public, even on rights issues, as any student of newspapers knows. On women's rights, on mixed marriage, even on slavery, they edge into consensus with the rest of the nation, region by region, amid conflicting claims to conscience. We'll hear how opponents of same-sex marriage plan to frame their argument next. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Another recent Pew Research Center report adds fuel to the charge that the media are biased in their coverage of gay marriage. Pew studied 2 months of coverage starting in the middle of March and found that stories from major news outlets featured 5 positive mentions about gay marriage for every 1 negative mention. Let's bring back Amy Mitchell from the Pew Research Center. She says the findings don't prove bias. The positive statements arose directly from the news.
Well, for example, Brooke, during the time that we studied over these 2 months, you have 51% saying that they favored legalizing marriage for gays and lesbians. You had a number of Congress members coming out to say that they supported the measure, from Hillary Clinton Rob Portman, Bill Nelson of Florida, Mark Warner, Claire McCaskill. The list is quite long. State legislation that was being passed around the country. Colorado passed a civil unions bill during this time period. There was legislation in Rhode Island and Delaware.
She says determining media bias would require a different kind of study.
One thing we would have needed to have done would have been to identify and measure to what extent there were events happening or public statements being made in opposition to same-sex marriage that the news media was omitting, was not including in their coverage.
The National Organization for Marriage opposes same-sex marriage. It's one of the groups that helped fund that Prince's ad we heard earlier. Thomas Peters is the group's communications director and agrees with David Dodge that the Prince's ad was a winner.
I think the reason the Prince's ad was effective, and I think this was borne out in our focus groups, was that it made people realize that changing the law about marriage doesn't happen in a vacuum. And that's one of the most continual arguments from our opponents. They say that changing gay marriage won't change anything. Well, of course it changes things. We just had a student about a week ago, I believe, who won his lawsuit at the Court of Appeals when his teacher started berating him for not endorsing the teacher's gay lifestyle. Gay marriage cannot simultaneously be one of the most important things America needs to pass and also have no effects on the rest of society.
Is that a theme that in this next phase of the battle will be put in ads?
In November, when we had four state races, we focused much more on the consequences of gay marriage. We talked a lot about the threats to individual liberty, people who have had their livelihoods threatened over supporting traditional marriage, to reinforce the point that if you redefine marriage, you redefine marriage for everyone.
An advocate of gay marriage said that his research suggests that the focus is shifting from harm to children to harm to anybody. He also said, somewhat ironically, victimhood had earlier been a big theme for his side.
Well, we're not trying to create a culture of victimhood. We're trying to prevent future victims. Even in the four states I mentioned, we normally had at least two ads running. One talked about the consequences of redefining marriage, and one talked about the positive nature. And, you know, the positive messaging, I think, is something that we have to reinforce, and it will be more of a mainstay going forward.
I just wonder if there's an ad that we could run a piece of that might give a sense of where you're heading.
Sure. I believe this was an ad that we helped Minnesota for Marriage air. About 30 seconds of women of various ethnicities looking at the camera and saying, yes, I think we should protect marriage.
In my life, I've learned to be open and kind to all people.
Everybody knows somebody who's gay.
Gay or straight, we're all entitled to love and respect.
But we can support gays and lesbians without changing marriage.
Marriage is still about children, having a mom and a dad.
I'm voting yes on the marriage amendment.
Yes to protect marriage.
Do you think the mainstream media are biased in favor of gay marriage?
The media is biased on this, not just in how they report, but in what they report. We won this year, for instance, in Hawaii, in Illinois, in Wyoming, but most people haven't heard about those victories. What they've only heard about are our defeats, and that's affected our messaging deeply in states. In states like Washington, where so much of the local news media is against us, frankly, we have to do double, triple, quadruple duty because people going through the nightly news are watching one of our ads compared with four news segments about all the discrimination that's happening in the state and how this is the only way to fix it. Being outspent and still coming within such close margins shows to us really how deeply seated Americans' views on marriage are in protecting it.
In 2012, a Maine court released the 2009 strategy document from the National Organization for Marriage that revealed strategies to raise issues such as pornography, to find African-American spokespeople, develop a media campaign around their objections to gay marriage as a civil right, provoke the gay marriage base into responding by denouncing those spokesmen and women as bigots.
You know, we've apologized for the language used in that document. It was just a strategy planning document. I think our public actions speak very well for us, how we strive for civility in all of our communications. We respect all sides in this debate. We believe that everyone should be treated fairly and equally, and how we especially honor and appreciate our deep ties to the African-American community, particularly African-American pastors.
The majority of Americans, including those who oppose gay marriage, believe that the legalization of gay marriage is inevitable.
Well, I would say actually that what we're seeing in the first 24 hours after the Supreme Court's handed down its rulings is that it's actually a very encouraging thing to our side. A lot of our people were expecting the Supreme Court would strike down laws protecting marriage in 38 states. The court chose not to do that. And so going forward, I think that will be part of our messaging, is that the Supreme Court has said it's up to us to win or lose this fight.
Thomas Peters, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thomas Peters is Communications Director at the National Organization for Marriage. A common refrain in the wake of the surveillance leaks by Edward Snowden has been, how much do we know? Or maybe, how much do we still not know? In an effort to defend its surveillance programs, the NSA released a fact sheet. But Senators Ron Wyden of Oregon and Mark Udall of Colorado noticed that the NSA's fact sheet wasn't entirely factual. Specifically, says Senator Wyden, there was something amiss with the description of Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Under Section 702, the government has authorities to collect the content of communications, involves a computer system called PRISM, and the idea is to focus on the foreigners and not just sweep up the records of law-abiding Americans. This fact sheet was portraying the privacy protections as being considerably stronger than they actually are.
And General Keith Alexander, who presides over many of these secret programs, withdrew it and sent you an apology?
I'm glad that they withdrew a fact sheet that contained these misleading statements.
But has he since corrected the record?
I have no information with respect to whether or not they're going to put up a new fact sheet. But some have said, you know, if a couple of senators hadn't spoke out about this, that information might have stayed up there forever.
With this fact sheet, do you think the NSA tried to pull a fast one?
I'm not going to attribute motives. What I will tell you is on occasion after occasion, senior officials in the intelligence community have made misleading statements about government surveillance and statements that have offered views that are simply far removed from the actual operation.
Are you moving for declassification so you can speak with more clarity?
This is a general proposition. We've got a long way to go in terms of getting into the hands of the American people more information with respect to the legal interpretations of these important laws. I mean, it's almost like in the case of some of these laws, as if they're two statutes. I mean, I often tell my colleagues it's like there are two Patriot Acts, and my constituents can't read the one that actually matters. They can go online and read the law, but they can't read the secret court opinions that have interpreted the law far more broadly than nearly anybody would have guessed. So there is a bipartisan group in the Senate pushing legislation that would require that the government be more open about the FISA court's legal ruling for public debate.
Given that you were fighting this battle in the shadows for so long, and now it's very much in the public, you must feel mind-blowing ambivalence about Edward Snowden's leak.
When there is a criminal investigation, I don't get involved because I just think that's over the line in terms of the role of the Intelligence Committee. But I sure want people to understand what the bottom line is for me. I wanted the administration to be significantly more open with the public about these surveillance laws a long time ago.
So maybe you're not that ambivalent.
Again, I believe this debate should have been held a long time ago. The American people understand that there are very real threats, but it is possible to fight terror ferociously and relentlessly without throwing our liberties aside. And that's what this debate's about. It is a false choice to say that liberty and security are mutually exclusive.
Senator, thank you very much.
Let's do it again soon.
Okay.
All right, Brooke, thanks so much.
Ron Wyden is the senior U.S. Senator from Oregon and a member of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Last Saturday, the Seattle Times published a feature titled, "She Stole Another's Identity and Took Her Secret to the Grave. Who was she?" Clearly, this is a mystery. One about a Texas woman named Lori Ruff, who committed suicide on Christmas Eve 2010 by shooting herself in her in-law's driveway. While the details of her death are clear, the family she married into knew virtually nothing about her life. But they quickly learned that she had stolen the identity of a 2-year-old girl named Becky Sue Turner, who died in a fire back in 1971. And then she changed her name again to Lori Kennedy. So who was Lori Ruff, really? The Seattle Times is hoping their readers will help them find out. It's published her photo and also, says Seattle Times reporter Maureen O'Hagan, much of the contents of a locked box that Lori had forbidden her family to open.
They busted it open with a screwdriver, and inside it was a birth certificate in someone else's name, the dead child, Becky Sue Turner. There was a name change in which she changed her name from Becky Sue Turner to Lori Kennedy. And there was a bunch of other documents, including sort of scribbles on a few pieces of paper that we think might hold clues to her true identity, and we've posted all that stuff online.
So how did you get drawn into this story?
There's a Social Security investigative division, and they do all sorts of identity theft and fraud cases. One of the investigators is here in Seattle. His name's Joe Velling. And a congressman's aide came to him and said, "Here's a mystery. See if you can solve this." And he thought, "Oh, piece of cake. No problem. I do identity theft all the time." He spent a good year and a half, and he couldn't solve the case. He called me up. It was probably almost a year ago now. I was able to convince my editors that this is a heck of a tale, and we may be able to help solve it.
But why Seattle?
The child whose identity she stole was from a town just outside of Seattle called Fife.
Mm-hmm.
There's some other connections to the Northwest. She lived, it seems, for a time in Boise, Idaho, because her first piece of fake government ID, it was real ID but in a fake name, was from Boise. She had a P.O. box in Nevada, and she got the child's birth certificate in Bakersfield, California.
How did you and the Seattle Times come up with the idea to get readers involved in researching the story?
A few years ago, we had done a story on a guy who turned up here with amnesia. He had no idea who he was.
And oh, that really happens?
I couldn't believe it, but it's true. So my colleagues here wanted to write this story. We don't know who he is. We think readers can solve it. And the editors were a little bit skeptical about this whole idea. A rule of storytelling is that you have to give some sort of satisfying ending, and we don't have that. They somehow came around. We published the story. Within a few hours, some reader in China saw the story, recognized the guy's picture, and identified him.
Wow.
So that sort of laid the groundwork, I think, for this. We talked a lot about it and how to approach it. We were concerned about what happened in the Boston bombing case, where suspects were misidentified by the crowd, I guess you'd call it.
The crowd particularly, although not exclusively, at the social network website Reddit.
We sure didn't want that to happen, and we thought this case is a little different because there's no suspect on the loose that we have to worry about the crowd sort of pouncing on.
So how exactly are you reaching out to the public? I assume you're doing it through the newspaper. Are you putting it anywhere else?
We are. We've posted it on the Seattle Times Facebook page. We've done a lot of tweeting about it. We've posted it on Reddit. They have this page called the Reddit Bureau of Investigation. It's sort of made its way to other places as well. But there's several ways that readers can contact us with this, and one is just the regular comment thread. There's also a form that we've created that goes directly to me if they don't want to post publicly in the comment thread. And I've been monitoring that, been monitoring Reddit, been monitoring the comment thread to make sure that what happened in Boston doesn't happen here, but also to see if there's any good clues.
What's some of the most useful stuff that you've gotten so far?
There was somebody who has expertise in what she calls forensic genealogy. The investigator, Joe Velling, contacted her to see what that was all about. Some people said, I think I know her from back in the day in Pennsylvania, and you might try looking here and there. There's nothing you can really grab onto, but it's all very tantalizing.
Yeah, somebody thinks that Lori Ruff might actually be Christy Lynn Farney, who she knew had been abused by her father, disappeared on her way to school from a foster home, whose life was incredibly troubled, and Lori Ruff displayed a lot of mental illness, some compulsive behaviors. Maybe it adds up to nothing, but it's an effort to tie a lot of loose strands about her life together.
It's sad, in a way, to think about who she might have been before. You don't just pick up and leave your life behind unless there's a good reason to do that. Whatever the answer is, I think we're going to find there was some trauma in her life.
And you really think you're going to be able to solve this thing?
I go up and down. I sure hope we are. All it's going to take is somebody to say, I sat next to that girl in math class in high school, or that's my sister. It may not be immediate, but I can see it happening.
Is this basically just kind of a game, kind of a crowdsourcing marketing game? Because our newsrooms have fewer and fewer reporters in them, and there are big issues that affect people's lives every day that go underreported. Part of me wonders, is this how you should be spending your time?
Well, I thought about that. This came up organically. It wasn't some sort of marketing scheme coming down from the publisher's office. We got to increase clicks. What I look for is a good story. And some are hard news stories and some are human interest stories. And I think this is just one of those human interest stories.
Maureen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Maureen O'Hagan is a reporter for the Seattle Times. Coming up, a mobster on the lam is now in court after his photo was ID'd by a woman on another continent. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting Games for Health, using video games to promote health innovations, at rwjf.org, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org, and wix.com, enabling over 30 million local businesses to create customized websites with the Wix website builder at wix.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
So here's the question. Did Whitey Bulger rat on the Italian mafia and other criminals, or did an FBI agent just make that up?
On trial in Boston is a mobster so rich with backstory it formed the basis of a Martin Scorsese film, the one that finally got him the Oscar. It's called The Departed.
I don't want to be a product of my environment. I want my environment to be a product of me.
That's Jack Nicholson playing Frank Costello, who's loosely based on Whitey Bulger, who played Robin Hood while acting like John Gotti. In the trial now underway in Bulger's native Boston, his lawyers are trying to discredit the 700 pages of his informant file. He says the FBI didn't pay him for information, he paid the FBI for info. And he says he was no snitch, and he didn't kill those two girls either, despite what his associates say. Actually, he's accused of 19 murders, but it's the snitch charge that really seems to rankle him, which kind of makes sense if you're from a South Boston neighborhood called Southie. Boston Globe reporter Kevin Cullen, co-author of Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice, hails from in and around Southie. He was the first to break the story years ago that Bulger was an FBI informant, and he's kept on the story for decades.
You know, if you're in South Boston for any period of time in the 70s or 80s, you would learn about Whitey by osmosis. So I would have knew he was a gangster and all that probably when I was in my early to mid-teens. So now I think of it, Brooke, I started covering him when I went to the Boston Herald in 1983. So I guess that makes it 30 years. He's always been on my back burner. And this year he kind of jumped to the front burner after he got pinched. And Shelley and I decided to write the book.
So set the scene for us here. What was the South Boston like that Bulger came out of?
Well, it was working class, even though there were many other ethnic groups there, particularly people from Eastern Europe. There would have been a lot of Lithuanians, Poles, Germans. And yet the Irish ethos dominated. I mean, even Albanian kids in the public schools were forced to learn how to sing Irish songs. That's the kind of place he grew up in.
Now, by the time Whitey was a teenager, he was already a petty criminal. He'd been jailed in the 50s. He served part of his time at Alcatraz.
He got involved in bank robbery. And in 1956, he was given hard time. He got 20 years. And he started in Atlanta. And then he was involved in an escape plot. And he was shipped off to Alcatraz, which turned out to be a boon to his criminal career. Because, you know, you and I were trying to impress people. We say we went to Stanford or we got our MBA at Wharton. And that, you know, when you're in the criminal milieu, they go, wow, you went to Alcatraz. That's very impressive. He first got out of prison in 1965. And one of the reasons he got out early, he got out after 9 years, is his brother Bill, by that time, was an up-and-coming politician. And he put together an amazing team of political people that helped get Whitey out. Timing is everything. When he was locked up, there was a gang war here in Boston, mostly involving the Irish. And by the time it was over, more than 60 men lay dead. Many others were in prison for the murders. And if Whitey had been on the street at that point, I think there was a good statistical chance that he either would have been a victim or a perpetrator. Instead, he emerged from prison to this barren landscape, this sort of the wise guy horizon was just wide open. And he stepped in and he filled that void and he rose very, very quickly.
Let's talk a little bit more about his younger brother, Bill, who was a star student and who rose in political influence. They stayed really close.
We saw this symbiotic relationship that Whitey, when he finally got out of the can in the mid-60s, he took a great interest in his brother's political career, and anybody that he identified as a threat to it, he had no problem intimidating them. We talked to Kevin Weeks, one of his henchmen, who said that there was a state senator who was challenging Billy Bulger's authority on the floor of the state Senate, and that Whitey instructed his henchmen to call the state senator and said, "We're going to kill you."
And where's Billy now?
When he left the state Senate, he was appointed as the president of the University of Massachusetts, actually my alma mater, so there. But he was actually forced to resign by Mitt Romney, who was then the governor of Massachusetts, because it was my co-author, Shelley Murphy, who found some grand jury testimony that showed that Billy Bulger was saying one thing out publicly and another thing privately to the grand jury. Basically, he said, "I'm not going to help anybody catch my brother, and I hope they never catch my brother."
Now, you write about Whitey, that he saw himself as a kind of mythical character.
Even back in his early days, say like late teens, early 20s, he lived in a housing project where hardly anybody had a car, but he had a car because he's a criminal. And he would take that car and he would drive around and he would look for old ladies trundling down Broadway with their groceries. And he would leap out of the car, gallantly open the door, put them in the car, bring them home, carry their groceries up there.
So he was the gangster with the heart of gold? But
sure.
But he wasn't, right?
No. He was very conscious of creating that narrative that he was a gangster with scruples and helping poor people with turkeys and blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, for every act that he did 400 acts of crime. He put knives to the necks of legitimate businessmen and said, "Give me your money. If you go to the FBI, I'll know in 5 minutes," because that was true, because the FBI was protecting him.
How did Bulger become an informant for the FBI?
Well, John Conley was a young man that grew up in the same housing project as the Bulgers. The first time he really met and exchanged words with him, John would have been like you know, 6 or 7 years old, and he was in the local drugstore, and Whitey Bulger, he's in there, he's the local hood, he's 19, he's got money because he's stealing stuff, and he asked John Conley and his little buddy, hey, what do you guys, you want an ice cream cone? I'll buy you a cone. And John Conley looked up and said, I can't, my mother says I can't take anything from strangers. And Whitey said to him, hey, we're not strangers. You live around the corner, and our folks are from Ireland. What kind of ice cream cone do you want? And Johnny Conley said, vanilla. Not long after that, John was getting beat up by a much older boy, and Whitey came over and pulled the kid, the bigger kid, off John Conley and said, go pick on somebody your own size. John doesn't see him again until one afternoon in 1965 when he's walking across the campus at Boston College. But in that intervening years, Billy Bulger, the little brother of Whitey, became a big influence on John. Billy, you know, was this studious guy. He's what we call a triple eagle. He went to Boston College High School, Boston College, and Boston College Law School. And he was a formative influence on John Conley, who did the same thing. Then he became an FBI agent, and that's when he gets back into Whitey's life. It would have been 1975, and Conley asked Whitey Bulger to be his informant.
He and another FBI informant, Steve Flemmy, became what you called the epitome of lethal hypocrisy.
Well, what they did is the FBI put them together. They were actually within the same gang. The way they handled the mafia cases, using guys like Bulger, murderers, to get at the mafia, that was corrupt. And the FBI was fingering their own people. That was what's amazing. They were actually getting their own people killed.
Now, in 1985, you join the Globe. Your best FBI source is John Connolly, who you knew from Southie.
He actually approached me. I didn't approach him. When I was working at the Herald, and said, hey, I know your family, I'm an FBI agent, we should get together. And he was a terrific source, and he knew everything. And I really liked him. He was really just a nice, fun guy to be around. And yet, whenever I would ask him about Whitey, I had no idea that John was his handler. And I kept asking about Whitey and Stevie, and he said, oh, they're good guys. I go, what do you mean? How can they be good guys, John? They're killing people. And the way he would explain it is, you know, there's always going to be gangsters, there's always going to be racketeers, but these guys are disciplined. They're not cocaine cowboys. They're not going to go out and kill women and children, blah, blah, blah. Now, John's telling me that, and then I have state police, DEA, Boston police sources who I trust inherently, and they're telling me just the opposite. They're saying these guys are bad. We believe he's a rat. There's no explanation of him not being taken out except that he's an informant for the FBI. So I had that all playing in my head when I went to Jack Driscoll, the editor of the Globe in 1988. And I said, Jack, I said, I know I'm the law enforcement reporter. If I write this, I'll never cover the FBI again. But I got to tell you, I think he's an informant. And every honest cop I know in town believes it too. And that's when Jack said, I'm going to put you with the spotlight team and we'll get to the bottom of this.
The Globe's investigative team.
Yeah. The irony is we had no idea how corrupt the relationship was. We did not know in 1988 that the FBI was actively assisting Bulger in targeting and murdering people.
So the series is about to come out and you get a call.
I got a call at the Globe office from an FBI agent named Tom Daly, who worked in organized crime. He said that a gangster called him and said, hey, the Globe's working on this story. They're going to say Whitey's an informant. And if that's not true, and if they put that in the paper, he'd think nothing about clipping him. Now, this is where the FBI
clipping
agent lost
you.
The plot, clipping me. That's when the FBI agent said, especially you, Kevin, you live there, meaning South Boston. My wife and I lived in South Boston. Now, the reality is that gangster was a protected witness. He would have no idea that I lived in South Boston. The FBI agent knew I lived in South Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And they were trying to scare. They did a very good job. I was scared. So before the series was published, we moved 9 stops down on the red line. We moved to Harvard Square to a hotel. And I'm like saying, these wise guys from Southie, they wouldn't be caught dead in Harvard Square. They wouldn't find us there.
Eventually, Bulger's relationship with the FBI crumbled. He fled in 1994. That's because the FBI tipped him off that he might be arrested. And so he went on the lam for 16 years.
Yeah, Whitey and Teresa took off. Teresa Stanley, one of his 2 paramours.
Mm-hmm.
Whitey stayed on the run for about a month with Teresa before she said, I'm not living like this, and please take me home. And that's when he traded in the older model for the younger model. And he got his mistress, Kathy Gregg. And she ended up spending that full 16 years on the run with him before he was captured in June of 2011, living in a rent-controlled apartment 2 blocks from the beach in sunny Santa Monica.
How did they catch him?
They could have caught him the first year, but the same organized crime squad from the FBI that was corrupted by him was put in charge of the search. The idea that these guys wanted to find him is ludicrous because all he could do is point the finger at them. So he's on the run, and then finally they put a multi-agency task force together. But the trail had gone cold. In the spring of 2011, the task force was down to just an FBI agent named Phil Torsney and a deputy U.S. Marshal named Neil Sullivan. The problem with finding Whitey is that Whitey looked like 20 million old Irish-American guys. There were sightings of him all over the world. But these guys had the idea, why don't we focus on Kathy? So a woman, an Icelandic woman, is sitting in her apartment in Reykjavik, and she sees the CNN report on CNN International, and she goes, I know them. That's Charlie and Carol Gasco. And she knew them because she used to spend part of the year in Santa Monica. And she actually was pretty famous. She was a, if you remember those ads in the 70s, Noxzema, take it off, take it all off. She was the model in that.
Nothing takes it off like Noxzema medicated
tea. And she appeared on the Love Boat and things like that. You know, married like a famous Icelandic rock musician and all that kind of lifestyle. So that's why she was in Santa Monica half the year. Kathy was a big animal lover. Actually, so was Whitey. Whitey liked animals much more than human beings. He was much nicer to animals than human beings. And so they kind of adopted a stray cat. Kathy would feed the cat every day, and Whitey would stand there dutifully aside her, and Anna would always come up and talk to them because she was a cat lover. She actually wrote a book about a cat. That's how she was able to put them together. She called from Reykjavik. She called the FBI in L.A., but then the L.A. office pushed it to the task force in Boston. Neil was able to track her down. And as soon as she said, she was very nice, but he was kind of nasty. That's what Neil said. That sounds like Whitey and Kathy. Rich Tien, who's the supervisor of the task force here, called the FBI in L.A. and asked them to check it out. And it turns out they did the right thing. They got him out, and he refused to get down on his knees when he was surrounded by this phalanx of FBI agents and LAPD. And they're pointing guns at him, said, get down or we'll shoot. And he goes, I'm not kneeling down, I'm not kneeling down. And everybody thought, when they heard that, that he wanted to die in a blaze of glory. But Whitey wrote in his letter that the reason he didn't kneel down is that when we looked at the garage floor, it was covered with like oil and gas, and he had white chinos on. He didn't want to stain them.
A rather low-key end to...
Yes, anticlimactic, I think, is the word we've used.
Now, how well do you think the Scorsese film called The Departed in 2007, mm-hmm. which was supposedly a remake of a Hong Kong film, depicted Bulger and Connolly? Because we're told that's what the story is loosely based on.
I thought it was a brilliant film as a piece of filmmaking. And Billy Monahan, the guy that wrote the screenplay, is from Boston. I mentioned that earlier. When you grow up in this town, you think you know Whitey by osmosis. We know that Whitey did go see the movie in Santa Monica. I think Whitey would have been appalled by that because Whitey's extremely vain and to this day was doing 115 push-ups in his cell. He's going to be 84 in September, and he would not let himself go like Jack Nicholson. But I think Nicholson captured the menace. You know, Whitey was a vicious guy. I think the public record's pretty clear about that.
And what about the depiction of John Connolly, the FBI agent who ultimately lied for him and covered up his murders?
Well, John, it's funny. And when you talk about this story really is a story of overweening loyalty. And at the end of the day here, as the Irish are fond of saying, John Connolly is really the only stand-up guy. Now, I say that knowing that he took money from gangsters. I say that knowing that he got people killed. But he also kept his mouth shut, which is amazing when you think about it, because everybody else rolled. The gangsters who claim that loyalty is everything, especially Whitey, who claims loyalty is everything. He's been loyal to no one but himself. I mean, Teresa Stanley was with him all those years. She died last year, Teresa, and she was a lady. She ended up spending the last years of her life carrying heavy trays, working as a waitress at the South Boston Convention Center. You know, Whitey dragged his own brother, Jack Bulger, who had been the clerk magistrate at the Boston Juvenile Court. When Whitey was on the run, he dragged Jackie into the conspiracy to get phony IDs. Jackie was convicted of a felony and lost his pension. So much for loyalty. Loyalty for Whitey went one way.
Where's John Connolly now?
John Connolly is serving 40 years in prison. He was convicted in Miami in 2008 for helping Whitey kill a potential informant. It isn't even something that had become an informant. And Connolly, by all accounts, is going to die in prison.
Is there any resolution for you in this book? The trial of Bulger has begun, but the larger issue of FBI complicity isn't going to be resolved thereby.
No, it isn't. And I don't think the culture of the FBI has changed that much, to be honest. I think they still treat other law enforcement agencies as lessers. We're still struggling here in Boston about what they knew about the Tsarnaev brothers who were behind the Boston Marathon bombings. The FBI had information about these guys and never shared it with local law enforcement, which is sort of par for the course. And you'll see the big shots get out there and say, oh, we've never been closer. We've never been more cooperative with each other. That's baloney. I know the real cost. I know the real detectives. I know the DE agents. They don't trust the FBI. That's never changed. And I think the Whitey Bulger case exposed that to its worst element. And I don't think it's changed.
Kevin, thank you very much.
Oh, thanks, Brooke. I had fun.
Kevin Cullen is a reporter for the Boston Globe and co-author with Shelley Murphy of Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice.
When you decide to be something, you can be it. That's what they don't tell you in the church. When I was your age, they would say we could become cops or criminals. Today, what I'm saying is this. When you're facing a loaded gun, what's the difference?
On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Olivia Wheats and Molly Buckley, and it was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news and our boss. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.